Gary Shapiro, and this is the From the Bookshelf podcast. Ellen Fitzpatrick is a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and has written many books. She was with us a few years ago when her last book, the New York Times bestseller Letters to Jackie, Condolences from a Grieving Nation, was published. Her newest book is all about women who have run for president of the United States. It's called The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Ellen Fitzpatrick, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
One day when I was reading your book, Donald Trump, you've heard of him, the Republican candidate.
So, yes, vaguely.
He said, frankly, if Hillary Clinton were a man, I don't think she'd get 5% of the vote. The only thing she's got going is the women's card. And the beautiful thing is, women don't like her. Did you hear him say that?
I did, actually, yes.
How did you react?
Well, the fact of the matter about that particular comment of Mr. Trump's is that Hillary Clinton has really benefited tremendously as a candidate from the gender gap that emerged first in the 1980s during Reagan's run for the White House, but has really persisted into the 21st century. And her polling shows that she does do well among women, particularly older women, and they've been an important constituency for her. So I'm not sure how accurate the claim was. It certainly wasn't accurate when it was made, and we'll have to see how things shake out in the November election.
Do you think there is a lot of resistance to the fact, I mean, if Hillary Clinton were a man and not a woman, if Hillary Clinton were a man and not a woman, how different do you think things would be?
Well, it's always, this kind of counterfactual is a little bit hard to puzzle out. I can only tell you that the themes that we have seen emerge in the current campaign are ones that have deep roots in the longer story of women's efforts to reach the presidency. Hillary Clinton has had a very unusual pathway to a national political office that in many ways resembles the path taken by her predecessors, who in the early 20th century often were able to, when they were occasionally able to hold national political office, women got there sometimes through what was known then as the widow's mandate. That is, they were appointed or elected to fill out the term of their deceased husband or father. And this was, in fact, how Senator Margaret Chase Smith from Maine, who ran for president in 1964, first entered the United States Congress in the 1940s. So we came to know Hillary Clinton through her husband's administration and through her service as First Lady. So in that sense, she does resemble some of her predecessors who reach the national stage through their husbands.
So as a historian, are you surprised that a woman has never been president of the United States? England just elected their second woman. I guess they didn't elect her exactly, but appointed their second woman prime minister.
I'm not surprised because I've lived through it. Through part of this history anyway, I'm a baby boomer and have seen, of course, the evolution of American politics in recent years when the modern women's movement has brought many more women into political life. But the presidency has remained a reach for even the best prepared of women candidates. So it's amazing to think if Hillary Clinton was to win this election that she would end her first term on around the time of the centennial of women's the ratification of the 19th Amendment in 1920 that gave women the right to vote. So, you know, it hasn't really been that long from the standpoint of American history that women were even able to vote in national presidential elections. My mother who is living, is 94, and she was born just 2 years after women got the right to vote. So it's not so surprising, but it has nonetheless been a rather arduous quest that women candidates have been pursuing.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Only, you know, in a, just over a lifetime, you're saying that women have been allowed to vote, let
yes.
alone run for president. But not being able to vote did not stop Victoria Woodhull from from running for president. So, talk a little bit about her. She ran for president in 1872?
Two, yes. She was a remarkable person who was born in 1838 into a kind of hard scrabble existence. Her father was a grifter. Her mother had some serious mental health issues. And she was married off at the age of 15 to a doctor who had been called in to treat her for a fever. He turned out to be a cad. He was a morphine addict, spent much of his time, according to her, in bar rooms and brothels. And she did have two children with him, but left him and married a Civil War veteran, a man named Colonel Blood, afterwards. And she had a career as a spiritualist and a clairvoyant, which led her eventually to New York City in the late 1860s, where she made the acquaintance of Cornelius Vanderbilt, one of the richest men in the country, who was a superstitious eccentric seeking to communicate with his dead mother. And Woodhull and her sister attempted to help him to do that, and he noted that they were the source of remarkably prescient stock tips. So he began to stake them, and Victoria Woodhull became very wealthy in the trading gold and bonds, and she and her sister opened the first brokerage firm run by women on Wall Street. And from there, she moved into the suffrage circles and then declared her intention to run for president in 1870, 2 years before the election year cycle really began.
And many years before women could vote.
Exactly. She said, "I can't vote, but I can be voted for." This was her position.
And according to the Constitution, was that a position? I mean, could she have been elected?
Theoretically, I guess so. She didn't, in the end, of course, do very well, but it was not for a lack of trying. She very boldly staked her claim and also attempted to enlarge the electorate by going before Congress. She was the first woman to testify before a congressional committee and had some support from sitting congressmen for her position that women she offered were actually already enfranchised under the 14th and 15th Amendment. This was during the Reconstruction period when the constitutional amendments conferring citizenship and voting rights on African American men were being debated, and suffragists were trying to get women included and under the terms of those amendments. So Victoria Woodhull took the position that, wait a second, you know, the 14th Amendment enumerates the rights and privileges of all those who are born or naturalized who are citizens and enjoy, you know, their rights and liberties. They can't be abridged by any state. So she wanted Congress to issue a declaratory act enfranchising women, saying, the meaning of the 14th and 15th Amendments are that women are covered by those provisions. That, of course, didn't happen. If it had, women would have been enfranchised a half century before they actually won the vote in 1920.
We're speaking with historian Ellen Fitzpatrick, and her new book is called The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. So did anybody vote for Victoria Woodhull?
It's a little bit unclear, Gary, because the way that the balloting worked in that period, there were specific ballots that were created for each candidate. And Victoria Woodhull wound up in prison on election day. She had been brought down by a scandal late in her, actually it was fairly, I shouldn't say late, it's fairly early in her campaign, when it came to light that she was living with both her ex and her current husband. She and her husband had taken in Canning Woodhull, the first husband, who was then dying of a morphine addiction. But this became a huge scandal and in Victorian America, and she was charged with lacking the moral virtue to be president of the United States. She came back swinging and accused the most prominent Protestant minister of her time, Henry Ward Beecher, of having an affair with a member of his congregation. So this set off a huge scandal, and she wrote about it in a newspaper that she had created to promote her presidential candidacy, and that was circulated through the U.S. mails, and she was actually arrested under the Comstock Act for obscenity and spent Election Day in jail. Incredible.
It really
isn't
is incredible.
It?
So she was, let's just get, piece this out a little bit. So she had her first husband living with her and her second husband, but was she living as husband and wife with both
no.
of them?
No, she wasn't. And her mother, as I mentioned, was mentally ill, and she actually sparked this controversy. One thing I think we can conclude from this is that a presidential candidate cannot survive their mother calling into question their fitness. Her mother had gone down to the local police station and said that she thought that Colonel Blood, Woodhull's current husband, was trying to kill her. And in the course of investigating what turned out to be a baseless accusation, the police discovered that Woodhull was living with both her current and her former husband. So this got out into the newspapers, and it was widely reported, and you know, she then became the subject of an enormous amount of criticism, and you know, was really dumped on for what was seen as a living an immoral life. She defended herself and said it was a charitable act, and she was proud of having brought, you know, brought Woodhull in to her family circle. He was the father of her two children, but in the end, it didn't go well, to say the very least.
She ended up in the big house instead of the White House.
She did. Yes, she did. She did.
Now, Margaret Chase Smith, is quite a few years between Victoria.
Long time, yes.
And Margaret Chase Smith, she was a Republican.
She was indeed, yes. A very accomplished woman, the first to be elected to the House of Representatives and to the United States Senate, and the woman who served longest in the United States Senate in the 20th century.
Now, your last book, Letters to Jackie, Condolences from a Grieving Nation, it's a wonderful book, dealt with the assassination of President Kennedy, and that really kind of played a role in Margaret Chase Smith's life and quest for the presidency herself.
It did. In the last press conference of his presidency, shortly before he left for Dallas, President Kennedy was asked about a rumor that was circulating that Senator Margaret Chase Smith might well be his opponent in the 1964 election, that she was considering competing in the Republican primary. And this is a remarkable, actually, audio tape that the Kennedy Library holds, where the auditorium is full of newsmen, and one of them poses this question to Kennedy, how would he feel about running against her? And the whole auditorium erupts in laughter, as if, you know, the whole idea of a woman running for president was outlandish. But Kennedy responded kind of puckishly, but seriously, and said that he would not look forward to running against Margaret Chase Smith, and that she was a formidable political person. And he then sort of gallantly corrected himself and said, you know, he repeated himself and said that she was formidable. And he said, if that is the proper thing to say about a very fine lady. Then a couple of days later, the Boston Globe ran a column by Bob Healy in which he said, I think the headline was something like, no laughing matter, that Kennedy was serious. He knew Margaret J. Smith well. She had crossed swords with him, so to speak, just that summer over the nuclear test ban treaty. He wanted her vote for that legislation, that treaty, and she didn't give it to him. So they had long known each other, and that's how it first surfaced. Of course, Kennedy died shortly thereafter, and Lyndon Johnson wound up being the Democratic nominee.
But also the death of the president, something in the book about how that meant that things were not as favorable for
Margaret Chase. And the issue there was really that the death of President Kennedy and the reality that a vice president and the choice of a vice president was so important, obviously important, and we're mindful of that now, but in that period, it had been quite a while since there had been an attempt on the president, a president's life, and never mind an assassination. And so it really was thought that this little boomlet of discussion about possibly Margaret J. Smith as a vice presidential nominee in the Republican Party, if not a presidential nominee, that really led some people to say, well, I could see a woman being a vice president, maybe, but even that they were backpedaling on when they thought, you know, actually that person could actually become president of the United States. We better rethink this.
And Margaret Chase Smith never thought about the presidency again in 68 or 72?
No. Well, she ran in 64. She did go ahead and run. She announced in January that she was running, and she competed in a few primaries. But she began her quest for the presidency by saying during those initial weeks that she would not make any campaign promises, that she would not accept campaign donations, and that she would not miss a single roll call in the Senate, that she intended to discharge first and foremost her duties as a senator, which her constituents in Maine had sent her to Washington to carry out. So whether those things together did not make for a winning campaign strategy. She didn't have the money to really mount much of a campaign, and she was very much hobbled in her efforts to really run in those initial primaries, and she lost quite handily.
Well, anybody with that kind of integrity has no business being president.
Not meant for the White House. It was it's an interesting thing, because that approach had been such a winning formula in Maine, where she traveled all over the state to every corner, small towns and to industrial cities and so forth, and really, you know, pressed the flesh and got to know her constituents, and they really loved her in Maine, and many still have fond memories of her to this day. But it didn't work in 1964 in the context of a national presidential campaign. We were already beginning to see, and had seen in 1960, the impact of mass media on not only the cost, but just the scale of presidential campaigns, the money that was involved. Primaries were proliferating, or would soon proliferate. And all of this led to the situation we're in today, where millions of dollars are involved in really being a credible candidate for the presidency.
As Shirley Chisholm, who African-American, who ran for president in 1972, faced similar problems with money in her campaign?
She did. She was trying to run a presidential campaign by charging her expenses to her American Express card. It was a pretty hard way to do it. It was a shoestring operation, but Shirley was intrepid, and she participated in many primaries, and in fact rolled up the largest number of delegates, not a huge number, but about 150, before Hillary Clinton the largest number before Hillary Clinton's 2008 campaign.
And what about Shirley Chisholm? Whatever became of her? I mean, I know she's no longer living, but did she ever think about running again?
She didn't. She remained in the Congress. She had had a very long career in Democratic politics that really began in the 1940s when she was a student at Brooklyn College, and she was just extremely courageous. She began attending the meetings of the 17th Assembly District Democratic Party, which was run by an Irish political boss and his machine. And she went into these meetings and would see many of the African Americans from Brooklyn and Bedford-Stuyvesant, her neighborhood, in there attempting to get some help from these elected politicians. And, you know, the racial divide and the inequality that seemed embodied in the whole system was anathema to her. So she joined in due course of time with other African Americans, and they managed to overthrow that machine in the that district in Brooklyn. And eventually she ran for the New York State Assembly, and then in 1968, she became the first African-American woman elected to the House of Representatives.
Would you say that there's something that, other than the fact that they're all women and that they all ran for president, is there something that Hillary Clinton and Victoria Woodhull and Margaret Chase Smith and Shirley Chisholm all share? Is there some quality?
I do think that that's true, and I'm often asked this question, and I think it's also true of men who run for president, and perhaps it's even more true for these women candidates. These people who see themselves as potential presidents of the United States are not your average bears. I don't know about you, but I have not had a day in my life when I ever woke up and thought this was a job that I could do and do well.
I want to be president.
Maybe when we were little kids we had this thought. But these were people who really believed that they had the capacity for leadership. And, you know, they had a healthy self-regard and were aggressive about pursuing their political career, as one must be if you attempt to reach this kind of height in American electoral politics. They were also extremely tough-minded. I think that, you know, in the 1870s, Harriet Beecher Stowe was asking of Victoria Woodhull's candidacy. She didn't like Woodhull at all. It was her brother, after all, that Woodhull accused of being himself a moral, morally compromised. So Harriet Beecher Stowe, you know, said, you know, what kind of a woman could survive a process that kills a man? And would we want that kind of woman to be the head of our government? And it's a question, you know, asked of Victoria Woodhull in the 1870s. It's being asked about Hillary Clinton today in 2016, a century and a half later. So there's a kind of toughness to these women and an ability to kind of shake off or to withstand the enormous criticism and the rough and tumble that is part and parcel of the American political scene.
Well, I really enjoyed your exploration into all of this. The book is called The Highest Glass Ceiling: Women's Quest for the American Presidency, and the author, my guest, Ellen Fitzpatrick. Thank you so much, Professor, for talking with us today on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show and will come back and find us again next week. I want to thank my guest, Ellen Fitzpatrick. Her new book, The Highest Glass Ceiling: Women's Quest for the American Presidency. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. You can find the program live every Monday night at 7 on KSCO in Santa Cruz. Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.